For many years now, I've had a special interest in how the church helps people who suffer from mental and emotional distress. Helping me discuss this today is a friend who I've met through my interest in mental health in the church. His name is Dr. Alfonso Nichols. Dr. Nichols, thank you for joining me today.
Pastor Tony, thank you very much for having me.
What I'd like for you to do is introduce yourself to our listening audience for a bit. Tell me a bit about your training, and then we'll talk more about your special interests.
Well, I am a child and adolescent psychiatrist. So I have done 4 years of medical school, and then 3 years of adult psychiatry residency, and then 2 years of child psychiatry fellowship. And the main focus I have is working with children, adolescents, and families.
Very good. So did you do your training here at University of Louisville or other places?
I did medical school at the University of Louisville. I did my adult psychiatry residency at the University of Cincinnati, and then I came back home here to do my child psychiatry fellowship at the University of Louisville.
Okay. I noticed in reading a little bit of your bio and the work that you did, that you'd received some clinical and teaching awards and some awards for humanism in medicine. Was that during residency or?
I had some of the awards I got during residency and fellowship, and then in my first year as faculty at the University of Louisville, I received the Golden Apple Teaching Award.
Oh, okay. When you were on faculty there with the University of Louisville.
That's correct, when I was on faculty there.
And for a time, you did some work at the psychiatry unit at CoSARES Children's Hospital, didn't you? What did you do there?
That was during the time when I was faculty. At first, I was just an attending psychiatrist up there, which is an inpatient unit where some of the people having some of the worst moments of their lives come. Mm-hmm. And the second year that I was there, I ran the unit and directed the unit there.
Oh, wow.
And then I left from that work to go to my next job, which was at Seven Counties Community Mental Health Center.
And then currently you are in practice here with Dr. Brian Briscoe at Kentucky Psychiatric and Mental Health Services. Is that your full-time position now?
That is that is part of what I do. My outpatient work, as we call it, where people come once a month, give or take, to be seen from home in the community, I do through Kentucky Psychiatric and Mental Health Services. I also do some work with places like Boys and Girls Haven, Maryhurst, and a place called Euspiritus. Those are places that are what we call residential facilities, where, you know, people have had multiple episodes of inpatient treatment and either have such complicated situations they haven't been able to get anywhere, or sometimes literally have no other place to go. And at that point, they will stay at a residential facility for a few months until we can get things sorted out, whether it's them getting better or a placement issue. Usually it's a little bit of both.
Okay. Now, when you go on site at those facilities, correct?
That is correct.
When you're there, are you doing individual work or group work, or is it both?
Mostly individual work. I tend to work with the kids as individuals, and then I work with what's called a treatment team. So we'll have the treatment supervisor, the therapist, and even some of the direct staff that work directly with the kids come together. And we all come together to try to figure out how the child is doing, what's next, what things we still need to address, and where they're going from here.
Good. Well, let me tell our audience what my purpose is in interviewing you and some of your colleagues. As I said early on, I've had a special interest in how the church helps people who suffer from mental and emotional distress. But strangely, in contemporary Western culture, psychology has been a touchy subject in the church. The church's history has not always been that way. We have not always been leery of psychological issues. As a matter of fact, in the past, the church provided some of the most sophisticated pastoral care that spoke to people at all levels of mental health and mental illness. Mental maladies and emotional maladies were seen as difficult and complex, but yet a normal part of life, even for the Christian. Today we have certain stigmas. We'll talk a little bit about why we might have that today. I'd like to hear your thoughts on it. But my aim is to help the church recover her sophisticated understandings of the human soul and develop more compassionate ministry for those sometimes who are stigmatized and on the edges of society because of mental health and the related issues. So you have participated in a panel discussion at our church with a couple of other psychologists and psychiatrists, which went really well. And that went so well, I thought the radio audience might enjoy it also. One of the things I'd like to ask first, Dr. Nichols, is I know some of your clients are confessing Christians, some are not. I would like to focus on the Christian audience first. When you have a Christian family come in with a problem with one of their adolescents, do you find that there are certain barriers that you have to overcome with them because of their Christian understanding of psychology, or is it just like anybody else?
It really varies from person to person, and family to family for that matter.
Okay.
When I do have to overcome that hurdle, a lot of times families are really being hard on themselves. So they feel like, okay, our child isn't doing well, so it's something that we must be doing in terms of sin as a family. And it's because of this sin that we just haven't discovered yet that little Johnny is having all these behavioral struggles or all these mood struggles.
Okay.
If we can, kind of take a step back and explore it and take a look at the whole picture, oftentimes, there are things that families can do better, but there isn't necessarily the sin that's been happening that they need to repent for. Especially in terms of depression and behavioral problems, there really may be a genetic component to that,
mm-hmm.
or a real psychological issue that is going on with Johnny that we have to figure out. And then if there are things to be addressed in the family, at that point, those can only help.
Good. Well, that's a great way to speak about it. And from a pastoral perspective, and I would like for you to comment on this and agree or disagree with it. It's almost as if you're dealing with this person on multiple levels as far as the source of the problem. It could be a sin source. There could be some type of sinful behavior in parent or parental relationship with a child, but there also could be just some incorrect learning in how to have family life or a genetic makeup. So you have the sinful side and just the brokenness of humanity on the other. And it sounds like to me that if you apply personal sinfulness remedies to just simple human brokenness, you could be doing harm to a family instead of good. Does that make sense to what I'm saying?
It makes a lot of sense. And in fact, if you have normal human brokenness, and let's say that one of your areas of brokenness is depression,
mm-hmm.
Then if you're looking for this hidden sin that you haven't committed, a lot of times what you end up doing is simply reinforcing your depression.
Yes.
And one thing we do know is that children with depressed mothers and depressed fathers tend to not only be depressed themselves, but also tend to have more behavioral and psychiatric issues.
Hmm.
And so if that's what's going on, the best thing that the whole family can do is really offer each other and themselves some grace and everybody try to work on getting better. And that's what's really going to be helpful here.
So then in a family environment, what I'm hearing is that it is possible to set up unrealistic expectations and unrealistic standards that we just might not be able to live up to. And so we're having a lot of pressure we're living under.
Indeed.
Okay. Very good. Now, I want to say strongly for our audience that we are most certainly not talking about a known sin issue and excusing any immoral behavior or personal responsibility. One of the things that I'm hoping to help the church understand is that we human beings, yes, we are sinful by nature and sinful by choice, but along with sin coming in the fall, brokenness came in the fall. That's why we have cancer. That's why we have heart disease. It's also why some of the mental and emotional maladies we have are here. Our brains are not a complete organ that functions as they were originally made to be. And it's compassionate discernment, I think, that helps people do that. When I've counseled men, or let's say a man that comes in complaining of depression, and I do a little history with him, and I find out he is in an ongoing affair, well, I just found the source of his depression. And that's the easiest one to find right there. So you've got a repentance issue. But when you're dealing with someone who is loving his wife and children and providing for them, but he just cannot climb out of this deep, dark hole he's in, we've got to show some grace, compassion, and a whole lot of wisdom to deal with that person. I appreciate what you said about that. Well, something keen to me is your area of expertise. You did your MD work first, correct?
That is correct.
Now, when you first did that, did you know you'd be headed into psychiatry?
Actually, no, I didn't. Before I had gone to medical school, I had worked at Our Lady of Peace Hospital.
Okay.
And I was a nurse's aide there. Didn't know anything about mental health at the time. I just said, boy, I need to make more than $5.50 an hour, which was minimum wage at that time. And they were paying more. And they looked at me and said, wow, young guy who can keep up with young kids, this is a match made in heaven. And after I finished there, I said, maybe I don't want to go into mental health. Maybe I want to do pediatrics. I really love kids, and I want to focus on the medical side of things. But when I got into my rotations, child psychiatry was just the thing that really spoke to me. When I was on the pediatric rotation, I found myself a lot more focused on whether it was the family or the social side of things. And then when I did my child psychiatry rotation, it really just felt like I was home and this was where I was meant to be.
So when you're in rotation in medical school, is that residency stage? Where, how far along are you by then?
That was probably in third or fourth year of medical school. Okay. And basically what you do is you rotate through all the specialties and kind of try them out for maybe a month or two at a time and kind of not only learn that knowledge base, but kind of see what you like and what might fit.
So at that time, you had definitely put in a whole lot of investment of effort, time, and money. And then you're considering after that going into psychiatry. How much more education did that mean?
Well, that meant another 5 years to do child psychiatry. And if I were to go into something like family practice, then it would be 3 years worth of residency.
Okay.
So to do child psychiatry added another couple years on.
Did you feel like you needed to see a psychiatrist to make that decision?
I think my wife felt like I needed to see a psychiatrist to make that decision at times.
I bet she did. That's terrific. Well, but you did end up with your focus in children and adolescents. Is it more adolescents now?
It's really about a 50-50 mix. Probably most of the time, the youngest kids that I see are probably about 5 years old on average. Every once in a while, I'll see a four-year-old. And a lot of times, I'm either looking at that saying, okay, you know, what's going on with parenting and family, or is there trauma, or... You know, these days you have to ask, well, all right, is this the autism spectrum? And a lot of times the tantrums and behaviors at 4 years old, even with a severely autistic kid, will get to the point where people say, you know, we need some help. We're drowning out here. And the oldest kids that I see tend to be probably around 17-ish. If the quote-unquote, you know, kids turn 18 while they're still in high school, a lot of times I'll see them because their world hasn't really changed and it's still things that I feel pretty expert at. But, you know, once they get out into the world and they're looking more and more like adults, it's time for them to see an adult psychiatrist if that's who they need to see at that point.
Okay. Well, you mentioned something that isn't my focus for today, but I think because we've mentioned it, we ought to address it just a little bit, and that is the autism spectrum. How long has it been called the autism spectrum instead of just dealing with specifically autism, or is that just something that's relatively new to me?
It depends on what circles, quote unquote, you travel in. It's probably been an autism spectrum for probably at least the past 4 or 5 years easy.
Okay.
It hasn't been called autism spectrum disorder per se. Codified until DSM-5 came out.
Okay.
And that's been about a year or so ago. But people who were really, parents who were dealing with autistic kids and people who were researchers were really calling it a spectrum for quite some time.
Okay. Now, some of our listeners will know what the DSM-5 is. Would you explain briefly what that manual is?
It is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatry and Mental Health. The long story short of it is, a long time ago, no one could agree hardly on what constituted what disorders. Mm-hmm. And people from the West Coast had one set of ways that they would diagnose, and people from the East Coast had another way to diagnose, and researchers really couldn't communicate very well. And so they got together and they formed the DSM and agreed on some common language for a few sets of disorders. And that has now expanded to the fifth version, which is now DSM-5.
Okay. Okay, very good. So it enables physicians, I don't know if it's researchers, but definitely practicing psychologists and psychiatrists to speak a common language when we're describing a malady that's evidenced in a patient.
That is correct.
Okay, very good. Well, as it goes through my mind, and I work with families as a pastor, I know the world has changed so rapidly that our children face things in much more abundance and rapidity than we did when I was a kid. The thought of having a phone you carried with you in your pocket only happened with Get Smart Shoe, and he dialed it from the heel. So it's like living in the days of Star Trek now for these kids, but they think it's normal. And it is to them. They don't know anything other than that. But I've also witnessed that fast pace being, our technology has outpaced the mentality and morality of adults. So I know it's putting more on children than they can deal with. My thought process is this. Do you see in the families coming in certain tendencies or repetitive issues that you're dealing with? Are there things you deal with more than others that are common?
I see. I do tend to see a lot of anxiety, a lot of depression. Sometimes that gets channeled into different behaviors. So whether there are fixations or obsessions, whether there's things like cutting that come up, those things really have increased. And it is such a busy world. Not only is there literally 24/7 access to all kinds of things that you would have never dreamed of 30 years ago, but you can reach across the world and access either information, content, or people that you never really could, which on the one hand provides opportunity, but on the other hand, it provides a whole set of pitfalls that kids may potentially fall into. And it really puts parents in a tough spot in terms of how do you keep up with these things and supervise?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was a kid, telling my age a little bit here, but when I was a kid, I was the master of the VCR. If anybody wanted a VCR programmed, they'd have to come find me because I could do it with my eyes closed, right? And all the people who are older than me really had a hard time with that. And now, you know, you multiply that by about 30, and that's the technology gap between current parents and their kids who would be the VCR generation. My generation.
Do you have parents that come in asking you for specific rules and how to help their children with these electronic devices?
I have parents who ask about them. I have parents who are so confounded by the technology, they don't even know where really to begin. And so, you know, there are times when we'll talk about what disorder is going on and then we'll talk about what treatments are going on. But there are times when we have to talk about technology. You know, here's the tablet that seems to have better parental controls than the other ones. Or here are the guys at the Apple that you need to talk to try to figure out how to lock this thing out or lock other content out. Or, you know, here's how you supervise this. Here's the program that's going to send you a report saying, here's what your kid's been looking at. It's a whole other layer of things to keep up with.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. You didn't know you'd have to be keeping up with that when you first started, did you? So you have to become a techno geek to be a psychiatrist for kids now. That's great.
That's about it. Couldn't have told me.
At least you can know the people to send them to anyway. That is terrific. Well, you mentioned anxiety and depression, and under those, I want to come back to those, but you mentioned one in particular that I know is a hot button for a lot of parents, and that was the issue of cutting. Now, is cutting a new issue, or are we just hearing more about it?
I think it's certainly not new. I think we've probably been dealing with cutting issues for at the very least, the last 10 years, probably a little bit before that, really. But I think we're hearing more and more about it because the longer things are out, the more, quote unquote, acceptable they seem to become with some people.
Yes.
And then these things get done not in the dark in the closet, but more in the light of day. Mm-hmm. And so then suddenly it's this issue that, you know, now can be dealt with. And then, you know, when you have things like the internet and the access that we talked about before, you know, suddenly there's a lot more sharing of these things that happens that ever could. I'll go back to my example. 30 years ago, you might have, you know, 10 teens in a school who cut. And unless they really talked to each other, it really couldn't spread beyond that. Mm-hmm. Whereas now you could go on the internet and find websites that really celebrate cutting and show pictures and show videos and, you know, really, dare I use the word, glorify cutting.
Yes.
And at that point, now you have lots of teens exposed, and the vulnerable ones may either say, gosh, that may be a way for me to express my distress. If it made Joe feel better, maybe I'll feel better. And then some will say, you know, wow, maybe that's a, you know, really something to do here. Mm-hmm. So let me go ahead and try that out as my next identity statement.
So would it be appropriate to say, with the way the internet takes something like that, that it is actually taking something that's mild violence and representation of an unhealthy thinking process or experience and actually turned a vice into a virtue?
If that thing seems virtuous to you, then yes.
Okay. And it seems if they're being displayed in certain ways on the internet as explaining how to do it and that it looks like a good solution, then maybe it would be seen as virtuous by some kids in a strange sense. Oh, what about the parent who never expected any such behavior out of their child and they find out that their child has been cutting themselves for 6 weeks? And they, normally my experience is the parent that has no mindset of that has never understood it or known about it, and they find out their kid's doing it, they usually go through the roof and typically have a response to their child that is not helpful to the process. What basic words would you say to a parent who finds out their early teen has been cutting themselves?
My first words would be, catch your breath, okay. Which is really hard to do. Mm-hmm. Because you're right, especially if you haven't been exposed to any of this or found any of it acceptable, it has such shock value that the first thing you may do is lose your cool or totally, quote unquote, spaz out. Either way, that response isn't helpful. If you lose your cool and become angry, you run the risk of committing what we call an empathic failure. You know, so mom, you don't understand, and now you're just angry, and I'm really hurting, and you're missing the boat here.
Empathic failure. Expand on that, the words, and give that demonstration, because that's a key thing, I think, for us parents as we try to relate to our children and not fear making that mistake, but learn how to avoid an empathic failure with our child.
It's all of us, you know, parents, kids, if we live and we breathe, we want someone's empathy. We mm-hmm. want people to understand us and understand our pain. And when we're hurting the most is probably the time when we need to experience empathy the most.
Good.
And so, you know, if I'll pick this scenario. So if your child has cut and they're really hurting and you lose your cool and slam your fist on the table and yell and scream, you've done the opposite, the almost exact opposite of what your kid probably really needs at that moment. Mm-hmm. You know, you could almost imagine them being three and what you'd really need to do is, you know, pick up little Susie and pat her on the back and say, it's going to be okay. And instead, okay, I've just yelled at you. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, when your kid is caught cutting, they literally feel that vulnerable. They feel like that three-year-old who really wants their parent to pick them up and comfort them.
Well, that's well said. So then what our child's cutting might do to us as parents is actually reveal our heart and not our child's heart.
I think that's well put.
So sometimes our reaction is out of pain, then probably because we do love our child and we see them doing that. And not only does it hurt physically, we know something's hurting inside. But it's almost like when your three-year-old, you mentioned a three-year-old, has done something you've told them four times not to because they're going to get hurt, and they do it the fifth and get hurt. You have that mixture of emotion of wanting to offer some kind of proper discipline because they disobeyed, but they are the ones that caused you pain, so you're angry too. The other one that seems to scream in my mind is that a parent may instinctively feel a sense of tremendous failure if that's not on their radar. And so that also might be the violent reaction in a parent's mind or emotions.
Failure and I would even say helplessness.
That's good, yeah.
And I think helplessness is such a strong and powerful emotion that it can prompt lots of reactions within us. You know, when we get angry, we feel the opposite of helpless. We feel powerful. Sometimes if we feel helpless, we totally spaz out. So we're not yelling and being angry and volatile, but we're, you know, just devastated with anxiety and indecisiveness and not knowing, you know, where this is going next. And that type of powerlessness and helplessness really freaks our kids out. Because if dad doesn't know what to do, or if mom doesn't know what to do, boy, this must be scary.
Wow, that is so important. You've given me a fork in the road. I don't know if I'll remember the second one. I'm going to take the first one. But speaking of that security that we give our children by having a proper response, which appears to be a proper answer, it would almost be appropriate that at that time we fake it by just taking a breath and keeping ourselves stable in the outside. But what I'd like to do first is take this issue of cutting. It's not the only one, but it is one that easily pushes parents past their limit. And I want to think about that, though it is a psychological manifestation. I want to think about it in light of the gospel, the light of scriptures, and how a misunderstanding of the scriptures or a limiting of the gospel may pour fuel into the wrong response to that. But a full understanding of the gospel would actually help that parent breathe in properly and get calm and provide that security. Where I'm going with this, and I'd like for you to comment on it, is if we look at the gospel and we think it through, then we're seeing a God who would understand this, and this is in the realm of what is common to humanity and not so far outside that this is really weird, I don't know what to do. So, what do we do with our children on a spiritual basis? Is there a way to not overly spiritualize what's going on and come down on the Ten Commandments? But how do we include this in our own minds and then to our children when it comes to this being really part of us? How does the gospel address this, or how do the scriptures give us a foundation to face these horrible issues?
I think it's really through the notion of grace. I think that's really where our biggest weapon to combat this within ourselves and our children comes from. Really being able to look at our children and say, boy, if you could do anything else right now, you probably would, wouldn't you? You were so at your wit's end that this is what you felt like you had to do. And so I'm going to catch my breath here, and I'm going to offer you some grace and not run you into the ground when you're probably already pretty low as it is. And what I really need to do is try to get you some help and build you back up. And once we're out of crisis mode, that's when we'll be able to have a teachable moment about how to treat your body as a true temple and how to really take care of your body. When people are really in that much distress, it's almost like there's a circuit breaker that goes off between their emotional brain and their thinking brain. And when they're in that kind of emotional storm, there's not a lot of logic going on.
Okay.
And that's really where you get, you know, teachable moments, is when we can sit down and be logical and talk about this.
That is excellent. It puts handles on things that we can grasp and actually picture our child's mind as if, yes, they're in their right mind, but not the whole of the mind or brain is working right now. And so they're actually thinking with how they feel. And thinking process or emotional processes are not cognitive. They're not factual. So we've got to calm that down and raise the level of the thinking faculty before we take that teachable moment. So what that says to me is that's where the gospel of grace applies first to the parent, that we can say, we haven't failed. That's part of normal humanity. It is a pothole in my child's life, but I need to come along to fix it, not to make it worse. And that would take a lot of grace for the parent to be able to do that. What I was trying to express earlier about bringing the cross and the grace in is I think grace is what allows us to see the whole spectrum of humanity. Because it's only at the cross where every piece of brokenness and every sin ever done is really faced and dealt with, actually. So when we see that and see ourselves in our true humanity and know that by the cross we can be accepted in the presence of God, it actually has a calming effect to realize I'm just like the rest of humanity. Instead of having these in-home standards that nobody at home could live up to and nobody in the world ever has. So just to bring reality to us as parents, sometimes we just can't see it that well at home. Well, that's the cutting issue, but let's talk about anxiety and depression. Maybe you can, maybe you can't, but what do you think in the people you deal with are any nameable causes of anxiety and depression in the lives of teens?
I think one word, which can take on so many variations, would sum it up, and that would be stress. And, you know, different things cause different stress. Once again, as you talked about before, you know, boy, if you have a real known sin, well, that is stressful. And we'd hope that that stress would push you to repent and live differently. But even outside of that, whether it's relationships, whether it's academics, whether it's family issues, whether it's grief issues, whether it's trauma, whether it's alcohol and drugs, whether it's internet porn, whether it's strangers that people meet on things like Kik and other messaging sites, there are all kinds of stressors out there in the teen world. And even if those things were put aside, you still have to stand on the principle that, wow, there have never been more people on the planet. And so whether you're trying to get into that spot in college, whether you're trying to get that summer job, it's a really competitive world out there.
That's very interesting to me on a whole number of fronts. I don't even think, as far as a personal vocabulary of meaning, the word stress entered my vocabulary until college or after college. What about you?
It was definitely late high school to college. It was probably that, oh, wow, you know, when do I get in all those college applications that you really started to talk about stress? But now the teens are talking about stress in middle school. Yeah. Like, we got to pick the right high school so that we can get to the right college.
Mm-hmm. Where in the world does such stress come from?
Yeah, I think some of it is from parents and teachers. We speak the language of stress. We speak the language of deadlines. But some of it is the world that we've inherited. We live in a world where it's no longer good enough to have your high school diploma. You know, if you want to be able to buy a house with two bedrooms and have 2.5 children to fill up that house with and have 1.5 cars in your garage, you really do need to continue with your education, and you're up against the other 20 people who are looking for that same spot.
Very good. Depression. Depression for some time seemed to be much more of an adult issue. Is it crept younger and younger, or is it just that we've been ignorant of teen depression?
You know, I think we've been, for the most part, probably more ignorant to teen depression than we had. Now, sometimes teen depression didn't hit as hard, and sometimes teens could have a little depression because life wasn't as stressful. So, you know, if you could kind of limp along and get to Christmas break and then kind of limp along to spring break and then kind of limp along to summer vacation, you could kind of get away with it a little bit. But, you know, now there's a camp at spring break, and maybe either there's a camp or a sport at summer, Or, you know, if you play a really competitive sport, then you might play year-round. You might just get into an AAU team. And so, you know, suddenly these places where your stress would decrease and you could kind of catch your breath as a teen, you know, those have evaporated somewhat. And so now we're looking at it saying, no, they just really don't have any place to catch their breath. Now they're just as stressed out and depressed a lot of times as adults are.
Okay.
I think the other thing that's coming to light is people are talking about it, which I think is a good thing. Mm-hmm. It's not the thing that the teenagers feel like they have to completely protect their parents from. Well, I'm depressed, mom and dad. And I think, you know, parents are able a little bit more to look up and say, you know, gosh, this isn't a personal failing on our part. Our, you know, mm-hmm. teenage daughter is depressed. Let's deal with it now instead of just saying, okay, let's keep moving. And well, you know, she'll get better. Christmas break's coming up soon.
I don't know if there is really any way to address this other than maybe anecdotal evidence. But because things are out in the open with teens and they are usually some bit close in community with school or things like that, they've got their friends, they're growing really closely. Are there times when a teen may feign a depression or cutting simply to fit in?
There are times, but those are actually pretty rare.
Okay.
And it's interesting. You would almost have to look at their peer group and say, okay, you know, is everyone in this peer group really, you know, this dark, deep, angsty, kind of depressed kid?
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time, no. In fact, I have a lot of artistic and athletic kids who are otherwise really well engaged who suddenly, you know, wow, their friend group is changing and their grades are dropping and they're staying out past curfew and what's going on. And suddenly you go, no, you're depressed. Here it is.
Okay. In a kid like that, are there other findable circumstances or causes that are normal that you found in different cases?
In terms of medical issues, every once in a while we'll say, wow, you have like low vitamin D levels or, you have a thyroid problem. Or, what about your blood sugar? You know, if you're a beginning diabetic, you may be very irritable, moody, or depressed. So there are lots of things that you'd look at. In fact, one of the things that we'd argue is you have to make sure that there are no underlying medical issues before you just kind of, you know, say, whew, glad that's, you know, not, you know, glad you just have regular old depression there.
Yeah.
And then, you know, once you've kind of crossed those things off the list and done your due diligence, then the next question is, okay, what's going on in your life? And you look for definable stressors.
Okay.
You know, have friends moved away? Has anyone passed away? Have you had an illness? You know, what about, you know, your academics or your social circle? Or, you know, has anybody started using drugs? And you really try to tease it out. There are times, however, where we really can't identify a whole lot other than the fact that, you know, wow, you know, little Chris has gotten depressed. Family history gives us a little bit of a clue.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have more depression in their families, and that does tend to make people more vulnerable to depression.
A man in England, the 1800s, most folks in the church know the name of Charles Spurgeon. He was on the tail end of the time when the church handled mental illness much better than we handle it today, typically. And he suffered from deep depression episodes of it. Normally a rather jolly man. But he said two things that stuck in my mind. One was, he said, I'm the pastor of a very large church, and I have found that some of God's finest saints may travel most of the way to heaven in the dark. I felt that to be actually a compassionate statement because those people were given grace to realize they're like everybody else, but their circumstances, they're just living with that, and it's going to be part of their doing. And the other one was, speaking of early onset things, and you may just be dealing with a teenager who's depressed. He said, it seems there are some that melancholy has marked since birth. So he had insight into genetics without having the knowledge that we know now. I think maybe, and I'm asking this as a question, is it possible that sometimes we parents may jump too quickly to our children's behavior being the cause of their problem? In other words, it's an acting out because, oh, they've got to be doing drugs, they've got to be doing this or something, when grades start tailing off or social contacts get less.
You know, I think when when we do that, what we're really reacting to are some of our biggest fears.
Mm.
You know, one of our biggest fears would be, oh my gosh, you're into drugs. Mm-hmm. And then we picture all the people who have had their lives ruined by drugs. Or, oh, you're having sex. Like, that's what's causing this. And so we kind of jump to that instead of, you know, being able to kind of take that deep breath and really inquire. And it's a real challenge. It's been a real challenge in my own parenting,
mm-hmm.
to kind of step back and say, okay, you know, let me not interrogate, let me not jump to conclusions, but let me just ask questions in a quest to truly understand.
Good. Say that again. You're asking questions to...
On a quest to truly understand.
That's great.
And in a cool and really dispassionate way. And I literally try to use the words, okay, son, help me understand. And I think there's two things. I think when you're in that calm moment, when your emotions are under control, your kids aren't ramping up their emotions waiting mm-hmm. for you to get upset and punish them. So they're able to give you more honest answers. But then two, once again, I go back to empathy. All of us want to be understood.
Mm-hmm.
Right at that moment, you've made Herculean efforts to understand. And that will get you so far, 9 times out of 10. It really will.
Good. Well, you made me think of something, and I'd like just your comments on it. When we do have a much more intense reaction to our children, oh man, it's my greatest fear, they're into drugs. Is it possible that our motive deep inside is, the higher motive is my reputation as a parent than my love for my child?
You know, I don't think you can discount that.
Okay.
I think it's one of the harder things about for teenage girls who get pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
There's shame for them already because a lot of times it's like, gosh, you know, I know my parents taught me differently and I had my life go in a whole other direction and now my life's gotten really complicated. But then there's a whole other layer because the family now has to say, you know, boy, we have to talk to our neighbors, go to church, go to school, and we have to be the Smiths.
Yeah, that's good because when we put the full context of our lives on our child's problem, it can magnify it. It can first show it in its right size, where we have to deal with it in reality, but it also can magnify it way out of proportion. And then we tend to respond sometimes to the magnified proportion, don't we?
We do. We do. And we even lose sight of who's in charge. Because in the end, God is going to write their testimony. We're not going to write their testimony.
That is excellent. So Dr. Nichols is saying to us that in any circumstance, good or bad, we have to remember who's in charge. And we don't write our children's testimony. God does. One of the most difficult things about rearing teenagers is your memory of your own teenage years. We're afraid they'll be like us. The beauty of that, however, is to realize how God wrote our own testimony and his grace towards us. And I think that's why, as I talked with Dr. Hutchinson, the parent who knows how from God through Christ to receive grace for their real needs, they're better equipped to give grace to their children's real needs. Couple more things before we wrap up, if I'm not wearing you out, Dr. Nichols. Anxiety, depression, and stress. We talked about cutting. What other manifestations do you find yourself dealing with in the lives of teens? Are there any other things that come to the top of the list?
There's everything from, I guess these would be more of the behaviors that my generation of people and before dealt with. You know, there's still kids who break curfew.
Mm-hmm.
There's still kids who sneak alcohol. Of course, there's more drugs around now than there were back then. I think, you know, various, you know, types of rule breaking. And then there are other things that are really self-punishing. If it doesn't rise to the level of just being an eating disorder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes I've had kids who even self-punish by starving themselves. Like, I'm not good enough to eat, so I'm just not going to eat here.
And you would say that is something different than a typical eating disorder?
It can be. With an eating disorder, typically there's a focus on body image.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is there's an obsession with, I'm not thin enough. I can never be thin enough.
So it's not rooted in self-punishment like the other.
It's not rooted in self-punishment. However, and this is the really tricky part, self-punishment can start to be an issue with those two.
Oh.
It's hard to kind of undo the two. But if there's not an obsession with body image and your teen is, you know, not eating or being really picky, at some point you go, okay, are you punishing yourself here?
Mm-hmm. I don't know that we have the time or any human has the full ability to do this, but what is it in a human being that could make us self-punish?
I think it's really, and you're right, this would need a lot more time to fully explore, but I think it is a real issue with shame and guilt.
Hmm. Shame and guilt. I think we all who are thinking this through and listening need to remember those two words. Shame and guilt are two things that came in the early chapters of the Bible. Anybody who just studies human nature knows we all deal with shame and guilt. But only those who study it and study the biblical wisdom of where that shame and guilt come from know how to deal with it fully. Shame is innate to every single human being on planet Earth. That was exactly what happened to Adam and Eve when we fell into sin. And the Genesis narrative tells us that the first thing they did was cover themselves. They were before naked and unashamed. Now they deal with shame. And guilt, of course, follows our shame. And because they were indeed guilty, but now because we're shamed and guilt, we deal with unrealistic understandings of them both, and they are deadly things in the human mind. There again, the gospel comes in at the core of psychological issues. The gospel is not the magic cure for someone who has an eating disorder or schizophrenia or depression. I'm not trying to say that at all. But the core issues all humans deal with, if we can address those with the gospel in a depressed person or a person with an eating disorder, then we are doing foundational work in their soul that gives them footing to stand on. Do you think that is accurate to say things like that from a psychiatrist's perspective?
I think that is extremely accurate to say. You need all of the different legs to get up under you. And without your spirit, where can the body and the mind go?
Mm. Good. Without the spirit, where can the body and mind go? Very good. Because we are a whole, aren't we? And one part of us, somebody told me a long time ago that the body and soul are so close akin, they catch one another's diseases. And that was well said.
I like that one.
Yeah. And our body makes our soul sick, and our soul makes our body sick. Well, Dr. Nichols, thank you so much for being with me today. It's been a great treat, and I know it has been to our audience.
Thank you much for having me, Pastor Tony, and I hope this has been helpful.
Oh, I'm sure it will be greatly helpful to many listeners. I'd just like to close us with a couple of words. If you'd like some information from me or our church, you can get us at lagrangebaptist.com or 502-222-9306. Thanks again for sharing this time with us.